1973, Richard Wynne Livingston wrote, "One is apt to think of moral failure as due to weakness of character. More often it is due to an inadequate ideal. We detect in others, and occasionally in ourselves, the want of courage, of industry, of persistence, which leads to defeat. But we do not notice the more subtle and disastrous weakness, that our standards are wrong, that we have never learned what is good." By cultivating the habit of reverence for ancient heroes, for the elderly, for leaders in one's own life, teachers were not only offering knowledge of what greatness looks like, they were trying to nurture a talent for admiration. Proper behavior is not just knowing what is right, it is having the motivation to do what is right, an emotion that propels you to do good things. School days were filled with tales, sometimes false or romanticized tales, of the great paragons of history: Pericles, Augustus, Judah Maccabee, George Washington, Joan of Arc, Dolly Madison. Character, James Davison Hunter has written, does not require religious faith, but it does require a conviction of a truth made sacred, abiding as an authoritative presence within consciousness and life, reinforced by habits institutionalized within a moral community. Character, therefore, resists expedience. It defies hasty acquisition. This is undoubtedly why Soren Kierkegaard spoke of character as engraved, deeply etched. VMI was an academically mediocre institution, and Marshall was not then a good student. But it held up heroes who were regarded as sacred, and the school certainly taught the habits of institutionalized self-discipline. Throughout his adult life, Marshall displayed a strong desire to be as close to flawless in all things as possible. Against the current advice, he absolutely did sweat the small stuff. VMI also taught renunciation, the ability to forego small pleasures in order to enjoy great ones. VMI was a place where young men from mostly privileged backgrounds went to get toughened up, to renounce the luxuries they might have enjoyed at home, and to acquire the hardness they would need to be worthy of the struggle of life. Marshall bought into the ascetic culture and its rigors. First-year students were compelled to sleep with their large dorm windows wide open so that in winter they might awake covered in snow. The week before he was due to arrive at the institute, Marshall was stricken with typhoid fever, and he was forced to show up a week after the other cadets. It was tough enough for the first-year students, and Marshall's sickly pallor and northern accent drew unwanted attention from his seniors. He was called Yankee Rat and Pug for his relatively snub-nosed appearance. Rat Marshall filled his days with undesirable chores, cleaning toilets a good deal. In his memory of the period, it did not occur to him to rebel or resent the treatment. "I think I was more philosophical about this sort of thing than a great many boys. It was part of the business, and the only thing to do was accept it as best you could." In one hazing ritual early in his rat tenure, Marshall was forced to squat naked over a bayonet that had been jammed into a hole in the floor. The ordeal was called sitting on infinity, and it was a rite of passage. While a crowd of upperclassmen looked on, he strained to keep himself from collapsing onto the point. Finally, he could take it no longer and fell. He did not fall straight down but to one side, so he emerged with a deep but mendable wound to his right rear. Hazing that brutal was against regulations, even by the standards of the day, and the upperclassmen rushed him to the medical center, fearing what he might say. But Marshall did not report his tormentors, and he immediately won the regard of the Corps for his staunch silence. One of his ex-classmates said, "By the time that episode was over, nobody cared about his accent. He could have talked double Dutch and they'd have accepted it. He was in." Marshall still did not excel academically at VMI, but he excelled at drilling, neatness, organization, precision, self-control, and leadership. He mastered the aesthetic of discipline, having the correct posture, erect carriage, crisp salute, direct gaze, well-pressed clothing, and the way of carrying the body that is an outward manifestation of inner self-control. During one football game in his first or second year, he badly tore a ligament in his right arm, but refused to report the injury to a doctor. It would heal on its own over the next 2 years. A day in the life of a VMI cadet is marked by the succession of saluting one does to one's superiors. And since Marshall could not lift his right arm above his elbow without pain, it must have been 2 years of discomfort. This starchy formality is not in vogue today. We carry ourselves in ways that are more natural and relaxed. We worry about appearing artificial. But those in Marshall's military world were more likely to believe that great individuals are made, not born, and that they are made through training. Change happens from the outside in. It is through the exercise of drill that a person becomes self-regulating. It is through the expression of courtesy that a person becomes polite. It is through the resistance to fear that a person develops courage. It is through the control of facial expressions that one becomes sober. The act precedes the virtue. The point of all this was to separate instant emotion from action, to reduce the power of temporary feelings. A person might feel fear, but he would not act on it. A person might desire sweets, but would be able to repress the urge to eat them. The Stoic ideal holds that an emotion should be distrusted more often than trusted. Emotion robs you of agency, so distrust desire. Distrust anger, and even sadness and grief. Regard these things as one might regard fire, useful when tightly controlled, but a ravaging force when left unchecked. People in this mold try to control emotion with the constant firebreaks of decorum. Hence all those strict Victorian manners. They policed emotional expression in order to reduce their vulnerability. Hence the elaborate formal way of addressing each other. People in this mold, and all his life Marshall was one of them, were deliberately austere and undramatic. Marshall scorned the theatricality of a Napoleon or a Hitler or even the histrionic display of two generals who would work with him, Douglas MacArthur and George S. Patton. By means not always subtle, one of Marshall's biographers wrote, the man whose mettle was fit for tempering grew from control to self-control, until in the end he imposed by his own desire those restraints upon himself which he could hardly brook when he first encountered them. Marshall was not funny, or emotionally vibrant, or self-reflective. He refused to keep a diary because he thought the exercise might cause him to focus too much on himself and his own reputation, or on how others might view him in the future. Diary keeping, he told Robert E. Lee's biographer Douglas Southall Freeman in 1942, might unconsciously cause self-deception or hesitation in reaching decisions, when, in war, he needed to focus objectively on the business of victory. Marshall never got around to writing his autobiography. The Saturday Evening Post once offered him more than $1 million to tell his story, but he turned it down. He did not want to embarrass himself or any of the other generals. The whole object of VMI training was to teach Marshall how to exercise controlled power. The idea was that power exaggerates the dispositions, making a rude person ruder and a controlling person more controlling. The higher you go in life, the fewer people there are to offer honest feedback or restrain your unpleasant traits. So it is best to learn those habits of self-restraint, including emotional self-restraint, at an early age. What I learned at VMI was self-control, discipline, so that it was ground in, he would recall later. In his last year at VMI, Marshall was named first captain, the Institute's highest rank. He completed his 4 years without a single demerit. He developed the austere commanding presence that would forever mark his personality. He excelled at anything to do with soldiering and was the unquestioned leader of his class. A letter of recommendation from John Wise, the president of VMI, praised Marshall's accomplishment in the unique tone of the school. Marshall was one of the fittest pieces of food for gunpowder turned out by this mill for many years. At an astonishingly early age, Marshall had constructed the sort of ordered mind that military men and women have generally admired. That person, then, whoever it may be, Cicero wrote in Tusculan Disputations, whose mind is quiet through consistency and self-control, who finds contentment in himself, who neither breaks down in adversity nor crumbles in fright, nor burns with any thirsty need, nor dissolves into wild and futile excitement, that person is the wise one we are seeking, and that person is happy. The service. There is always an interesting moment in the lives of successful people when they first learn how to work. For Marshall, that moment came at BMI. To get an appointment to the U.S. Army, he needed political support. He went to Washington and showed up at the White House without an appointment. He worked his way up to the second floor, where one of the ushers told him it was impossible for him just to burst in and see the president. But Marshall sneaked into the Oval Office with a larger group, and after they left, he stated his case to President McKinley. Whether McKinley intervened is unclear, but in 1901, Marshall was permitted to take the Army entrance exam, and in 1902, he received his commission. Like Eisenhower, Marshall was a late bloomer. He worked professionally. He served other men, but he did not rise spectacularly. He was such a valuable aide, his superiors sometimes held him back from getting his own command. Lieutenant Colonel Marshall's special fitness is staff work, one general wrote. I doubt that in this, whether it be teaching or practice, he has any equal in the Army today. He was such a genius at the dull background work of military life, especially logistics, that he was not pushed forward to the fighting edge. By age 39, at the end of his service in World War I, he was still only a temporary lieutenant colonel, surpassed by younger men who had held combat commands. He suffered grievously with each disappointment. But he was slowly acquiring skills. During postgraduate training at Fort Leavenworth, Marshall became an autodidact, compensating for his lamentable academic record. He was shuffled to the Philippines and across the American South and Midwest, serving as engineering officer, ordnance officer, post-quartermaster, post-commissary officer, and another undistinguished staff positions. Each day passed to the rhythm of his daily chores and minor accomplishments. However, his attention to detail and endurance would serve him later on. As he later observed, the truly great leader overcomes all difficulties, and campaigns and battles are nothing but a long series of difficulties to be overcome. He sublimated his ego. The less you agree with the policies of your superiors, the more energy you must direct to their accomplishment. Biographers have scoured his life, and the most striking feature is what they don't find, any moment of clear moral failure. He made many poor decisions, but there is no clear moment when he committed adultery, betrayed his friends, told an egregious lie, or let himself and others down. Though promotions did not come, Marshall began to develop a reputation as a legendary master of organization and administration. It was not exactly the glamour side of military life. In 1912, he organized maneuvers involving 17,000 officers and men in the United States. In 1914, during a training exercise in the Philippines, he effectively commanded an invading force of 4,800 men to tactically outmaneuver and defeat the defending force. In World War I, Marshall served as an assistant to the Chief of Staff of the American Expeditionary Force, AEF, for the 1st Division in France. It was the first division ever fielded by the American Army in Europe, and, contrary to popular belief, Marshall saw more action and ducked more shot, shells, and gas attacks than many other Americans in the war. His assignment was to keep AEF headquarters informed about the frontline supplies, position, and morale of the men. Much of his time was spent on or near the front in France, jumping in and out of trenches, checking in with the soldiers, and taking note of what they most desperately needed. The moment he returned safely to headquarters, he would report to the chief and begin mapping out logistics for the next massive movement of men to or from the line. In one operation, he organized the movement of 600,000 men and 900,000 tons of supplies and ammunition from one sector to another part of the front. It was the most complicated logistics problem of the war, and Marshall's performance became legendary, earning him the temporary nickname Wizard. During October 1917, Marshall's unit received a visit from General John Blackjack Pershing, the senior U.S. commander in the war. Pershing ripped into the unit for its poor training and performance, upbraiding Marshall's immediate commanding officer, General William Seibert, and Seibert's chief of staff, who had arrived only 2 days earlier. Marshall, then a captain, decided it was time for what he called a sacrifice play. He stepped forward and attempted to explain the situation to the general. An already irate Pershing silenced Marshall and turned away. Marshall then did something that could have cost him his career. He placed his hand on Pershing's arm to prevent him from leaving. He vehemently countered the old man, overwhelming him with a torrent of facts about the failures of Pershing's own headquarters, about poor supplies, the misplacement of the troops, the lack of motor transport, and many other hurdles not to be overlooked. There was a long silence, and everyone stood amazed by Marshall's effrontery. Pershing looked at him narrowly and responded defensively, "Well, you have to appreciate the problems we have." Marshall shot back, "Yes, General, but we have them every day and many a day, and we have to solve every one of them by night." Pershing said nothing and stalked off angrily. Marshall's colleagues thanked him and told him his career was finished. Instead, Pershing remembered the younger man, hired him, and became his most important mentor. Marshall was shocked by the letter he received, summoning him to join the general staff at its headquarters in Chaumont. He ached for a promotion that would position him to lead men into battle. However, he packed his bags immediately and said goodbye to the men he had known for more than a year. Tucked between war reports, Marshall wrote an uncharacteristically sentimental description of his departure. "It was hard to preserve one's composure to these men with whom I had been so intimately associated for over a year in France. We had been prisoners, and our trials and tribulations had seemed to bind us very close to one another. I can see them now, gathered in the broad doorway of the chateau. The friendly jests and affectionate farewells, as I got into the Cadillac, made a deep impression on my mind, and I drove off, hardly daring to wonder when and where would be our next meeting." 6 days later, the 1st Division joined the great counterattack that would lead to the retreat of the German army. And within 72 hours, most of the men in that doorway, and every field officer, battalion commander, and the 4 lieutenants of the 1st Division were casualties, either dead or wounded. In 1918, in France, Marshall was close to being promoted to brigadier general. The war ended, and it would take him 18 long years to get his first star. He returned home, where he spent 5 years under Pershing in Washington doing paperwork. He served his superior officers but received few promotions for himself. Through it all, Marshall worked on his profession and served his institution, the U.S. Army. Institutions. Today it is unusual to meet someone with an institutional mindset. We live in an age of institutional anxiety, when people are prone to distrust large organizations. This is partly because we've seen the failure of these institutions, and partly because, in the era of the big me, we put the individual first. We tend to prize the freedom to navigate as we wish, to run our lives as we choose, and never to submerge our own individual identities in conformity to some bureaucracy or organization. We tend to assume that the purpose is to lead the richest and fullest individual life, jumping from one organization to the next as it suits our needs. Meaning is found in these acts of self-creation, in the things we make and contribute to, in our endless choices. Nobody wants to be an organization man. We like startups, disruptors, and rebels. There's less prestige accorded to those who tend to the perpetual reform and repair of institutions. Young people are raised to think that big problems can be solved by a swarm of small, networked NGOs and social entrepreneurs. Big hierarchical organizations are dinosaurs. This mentality has contributed to institutional decay. As the editor Tina Brown has put it, if everybody is told to think outside the box, you've got to expect that the boxes themselves will begin to deteriorate. People who possess an institutional mindset, as Marshall did, have a very different mentality, which begins with a different historical consciousness. In this mindset, the primary reality is society, which is a collection of institutions that have existed over time and transcend generations. A person is not born into an open field and a blank social slate. A person is born into a collection of permanent institutions, including the army, the priesthood, the fields of science, or any of the professions, like being a farmer, a builder, a cop, or a professor. Life is not like navigating through an open field. It is committing oneself to a few of the institutions that were embedded on the ground before you were born and will be here after you die. It is accepting the gifts of the dead, taking on the responsibility of preserving and improving an institution, and then transmitting that institution, better, on to the next generation. Each institution comes with certain rules, obligations, and standards of excellence. Journalism imposes habits that help reporters keep a mental distance from those they cover. Scientists have certain methods they use to advance and verify knowledge one step at a time. Teachers treat all their students equally and invest extra hours to their growth. In the process of subordinating ourselves to the institutions we inhabit, we become who we are. The customs of the institution structure the soul, making it easier to be good. They guide behavior gently along certain time-tested lines. By practicing the customs of an institution, we are not alone. We are admitted into a community that transcends time. With this sense of scope, the institutionalist has deep reverence for those who came before and the rules he has temporarily taken delivery of. The rules of a profession or an institution are not like practical tips on how to best do something. They are deeply woven into the identities of the people who practice them. A teacher's relationship to the craft of teaching, an athlete's relationship to his or her sport, a doctor's commitment to the craft of medicine is not an individual choice that can be easily renounced when the psychic losses exceed the psychic benefits. These are life-shaping and life-defining commitments. Like finding a vocation, they are commitments to something that transcends a single lifetime. A person's social function defines who he or she is. The commitment between a person and an institution is more like a covenant. It is an inheritance to be passed on and a debt to be repaid. The technical tasks of, say, being a carpenter are infused with the deep meaning that transcends the task at hand. There are long periods when you put more into your institutions than you get out of them, but service to the institution provides you with a series of fulfilling commitments and a secure place in the world. It provides you with a means to submerge your ego, to quiet its anxieties and its relentless demands. Marshall conformed his life to the needs of his organization. Very few people in the course of the last century aroused as much reverence as Marshall did, even in his own lifetime, even among people who knew him well. There were also few people who felt entirely comfortable around him, Eisenhower included. The cost of his perfect self-denial and self-control was aloofness. While in uniform, he never let his hair down or allowed people into the intimacy of his own soul. He maintained his composure in all circumstances. Love and death. Marshall did have a private life. It was starkly separated from his public role. Today we bring our work home, returning work emails on our phones. But for Marshall, these were two separate spheres, with different emotions and patterns of conduct. The home was a haven in a heartless world. Marshall's home life centered on his wife, Lily. George Marshall wooed Elizabeth Carter Coles, known to her friends as Lily, while in his final year at VMI. They took long carriage rides, and at night he risked expulsion by sneaking off grounds to be with her. George was 6 years Lily's junior, and several other senior classmates and senior VMI graduates, including Marshall's older brother Stuart, had done their best to win her fancy. She was a striking dark beauty and the reigning belle of Lexington. "I was much in love," he recalled, "and it was for keeps." They married shortly after his graduation in 1902. He felt himself extraordinarily lucky to have won her, and he carried that gratitude with him forever after. His attitude toward Lily can be described as constant and extremely solicitous. Shortly after their marriage, he discovered that she suffered from a thyroid condition that gave her an extremely weak heart. She would have to be treated as a semi-invalid all her life. They could never risk having children. There would always be the possibility of sudden death by exertion. But Marshall's devotion and gratitude to his wife only deepened. Marshall was pleased to put himself in her service, supplying her with little surprises, compliments, and comforts, always giving the greatest attention to the smallest details. She would never be allowed to rise to retrieve that needlepoint basket she had forgotten upstairs. Marshall was playing the role of the chivalric knight in service to his lady. Lily sometimes looked upon this with wry amusement. She was more rugged and capable than he thought, but it gave him such pleasure to look after her. In 1927, when Lily was 53, her heart condition worsened. She was taken to Walter Reed Hospital, and on August 22nd an operation was performed. Her recovery was slow but steady. Marshall was in his element, catering to her every need, and Lily seemed to be recovering. On September 15th, she was told that she could return home the next day. She sat down to send her mother a note. She wrote the word George, slumped over, and passed away. The doctors said it was her excitement over returning home that elevated her pulse irregularly. Marshall was teaching classes at the War College in Washington at that moment. A guard interrupted his lecture and called him to the telephone. They went into a little office where Marshall took the call, listened for a few moments, and then put his head on his arms on the desk. The guard asked if there was any way he could be of assistance. Marshall replied with quiet formality, "No, Mr. Throckmorton. I just had word my wife, who was to join me here today, has just died." The formality of that phrasing, the pause to remember the guard's name — Marshall was not good with names — perfectly captured his emotional self-control, his self-discipline at all times. Marshall was stricken by his wife's death. He filled his home with photographs of her, so that she looked out at him from nearly every vantage point in every room. Lily had been not only his sweet wife, but his most trusted confidant, and, it seemed, his only one. Only she had been privileged to see the burden he carried and help him bear it. Suddenly and brutally, he was alone and adrift. General Pershing, who had lost a wife and three daughters, wrote a note of condolence. Marshall replied that he missed Lily desperately. 26 years of most intimate companionship, something I have never known since I was a mere boy, leave me lost in my best efforts to adjust myself to future prospects in life. If I had been given to club life or other intimacies with men outside of athletic diversion, or if there was a campaign on or other pressing duty that demanded concentrated effort, then I think I could do better. However, I will find a way. Lily's death changed Marshall. Once taciturn, he softened and became conversational, as if he could charm visitors into staying and filling the lonely hours. Over the years, his letters became more thoughtful, more openly compassionate. Despite his commitment to the service and several periods when work consumed him, Marshall had never been a workaholic. Careful not to strain his own health, he broke off work in late afternoon to garden, go horseback riding, or take a walk. Whenever possible, he encouraged, even ordered, his staff to do the same. Privacy. Marshall was a private man. That is to say, he made a stronger distinction than many people today make between the private and public spheres, between those people he considered intimates and everybody else. He could be witty and tell long, funny stories to people within the inner circle of his trust and affection, but his manner to the larger population was defined by courtliness and a certain reserved charm. Very rarely did he call anyone by their first name. This code of privacy is different from the one that is common in the era of Facebook and Instagram. This privacy code, which he shared with Francis Perkins, is based on the notion that this zone of intimacy should be breached only gradually, after long reciprocity and trust. The contents of the private world should not instantly be shared online or in conversation. They should not be tweeted. Marshall's polite social manner matched his polite inner makeup. The French philosopher André Comte Sponville argues that politeness is the prerequisite for the great virtues. Morality is like a politeness of the soul, an etiquette of inner life, a code of duties. It is a series of practices that make you considerate of others. Marshall was unfailingly considerate, but his formality made it hard for him to develop friendships. He strongly disapproved of gossip. He frowned at off-color stories, and he never enjoyed the garrulous relationships with men that Ike specialized in. Marshall's early biographer, William Fry, wrote, "Marshall was one of those controlled and disciplined people who find both incentive and reward deep within themselves, who require neither urging nor applause from many men. Such people are terribly alone, without the release most find in the easy sharing of mind and heart with many people. For all their self-sufficiency, they are incomplete. And if they are fortunate, they find completion in one or two others. There are not more than two, usually, the heart opened to a lover, the mind to a friend." Reformer. Marshall finally found respite from his grief with an assignment that consumed his energies. At the end of that year, he was asked to lead the infantry school program at Fort Benning, Georgia. Marshall was conservative in manners, but he was not a traditionalist when it came to operations. All his life he pushed against what he regarded as the stifling traditionalism of the Army way of doing things. In his 4 years there, he revolutionized officer training, and since many of the most important officers of World War II passed through Fort Benning during his time there, he revolutionized the U.S. Army, too. The lesson plans he inherited were built on the ridiculous premise that in battle, officers would have complete information about their troops' positions and the enemy's. He sent them out on maneuvers without maps or without dated ones, telling them that in a real war, the maps would be either absent or worse than useless. He told them the crucial issue is usually when a decision should be made as much as what the decision should be. He told them that mediocre solutions undertaken in time were better than perfect solutions undertaken too late. Until Marshall, professors wrote their lectures and simply read them out to the class. Marshall prohibited the practice. He cut the supply systems manual from 120 pages down to 12, to make training a citizen force easier and to allow greater discretion down the chain of command. Even his success and reforms did not speed his promotions. The army had its own seniority system. But as the 1930s wore on and the fascist threat became clearer, personal merit began to count for more. Eventually, Marshall received a series of large promotions, leapfrogging senior but less admired men, all the way to Washington and the centers of power. The General. In 1938, Franklin Roosevelt held a cabinet meeting to discuss strategy for an arms buildup. FDR argued that the next war would be largely determined by air and sea power, not ground troops. He went around the room, looking for agreement, and was met with general assent. Finally, he turned to Marshall, the new deputy chief of staff, and asked, "Don't you think so, George?" "I am sorry, Mr. President, but I don't at all." Marshall made the case for land forces. FDR looked startled and called the meeting to a close. It was the last time the president would presume to call Marshall by his first name. In 1939, FDR had to replace the outgoing chief of staff, the top position in the U.S. military. Marshall at that time ranked 34th in seniority, but the contest came down to him and Hugh Drum. Drum was a talented general, but also a bit pompous, and he organized a lavish campaign for the job, lining up letters of endorsement and organizing a series of positive articles in the press. Marshall refused to campaign, and squashed efforts by others to campaign on his behalf. But he did have key friends in the White House, the most important of whom was Harry Hopkins, an FDR intimate who was an architect of the New Deal. FDR went with Marshall, though there was little personal warmth between them. War is a series of blunders and frustrations. At the outset of the Second World War, Marshall understood he would have to ruthlessly cull the incompetent from their jobs. By this time, he was married to his second wife, Catherine Tupper Brown, a glamorous former actress with a strong personality and an elegant manner, who would become Marshall's constant companion. "I cannot afford the luxury of sentiment," he told her. "Mine must be cold logic. Sentiment is for others. I cannot allow myself to get angry. That would be fatal. It is too exhausting. My brain must be kept clear. I cannot afford to appear tired." The culling process was brutal. Marshall ended the careers of hundreds of colleagues. "He was once our dear friend, but he ruined my husband," a senior officer's wife observed after her husband had been shoved aside. One evening, he told Catherine, "I get so tired of saying no. It takes it out of me." Organizing his department while war loomed, Marshall observed, "It is not easy to tell men where they have failed. My days seem to be filled with situations and problems where I must do the difficult, the hard thing." A vintage Marshall performance was given at a meeting with the press in London in 1944. He entered the room without any papers and began by instructing each reporter to ask a question while he listened. After 30-plus questions, Marshall explained in detail the situation of the war, addressing the larger visions, strategic goals, and technical details, shifting his eyes deliberately to a different face every few sentences. Then he finished, 40 minutes later, and thanked the reporters for their time. World War II had its share of cinematic generals, like MacArthur and Patton, but most, like Marshall and Eisenhower, were anti-cinematic. They were precise organizers, not flamboyant showmen. Marshall detested generals who screamed and pounded tables. He favored the simple, spare uniform rather than the more decorated uniform favored by generals today, with their placards of ribbons forming a billboard across their chests. During this time, Marshall developed an astounding reputation. The general view was summarized by the CBS war correspondent Eric Severide. "A hulking, homely man of towering intellect, the memory of an unnatural genius, and the integrity of a Christian saint. The atmosphere of controlled power he exuded made one feel oneself a physical weakling, and his selfless devotion to duty was beyond all influences of public pressure or personal friendship. Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn said no other American had equal influence with Congress. "We are in the presence of a man who is telling the truth as he sees it." As Truman's Secretary of State, Dean Acheson put it, "The thing that stands out in everybody's recollection of General Marshall is the immensity of his integrity." That integrity did not win him immediate favor with everybody. He held the soldiers' contempt for politics and remembered his particular disgust when he once met with President Roosevelt to tell him that the plans for the North African invasion were ready. The president clapped his hands together in mock prayer and said, "Please make it before Election Day." Marshall's deputy chief of staff, Tom Handy, later explained in an interview, "It's no use saying General Marshall was an easy man, because he wasn't. He could be extremely rigid, but he had a terrific influence and power, especially over the British and Congress. I think FDR envied him this. I think that the basis was that they knew in Marshall's case there was no underhanded or selfish motive. The British knew that he was not out to make American points or British points, but trying to win the war the best way. The Congress knew he was talking to them straight, with no politics involved." The quintessential Marshall moment came in the middle of the war. The Allies were planning Operation Overlord, the invasion of France, but still no overall commander had been selected. Marshall secretly craved the assignment and was widely accepted as the most qualified for it. This would be among the most ambitious military operations ever attempted, and whoever commanded it would be performing a great service to the cause and would go down in history as a result of it. The other Allied leaders, Churchill and Stalin, told Marshall that he would get the job. Eisenhower assumed Marshall would get the job. Roosevelt knew that if Marshall asked for the job, he would have to give it to him. He had earned it, and his stature was so high. But Roosevelt relied on Marshall to be nearby in Washington, whereas the Overlord commander would go to London. FDR may also have had doubts about Marshall's austere personality. Commanding Overlord would mean managing political alliances, and a warm touch might come in handy. The controversy flared. Several senators argued that Marshall was needed in Washington and should not get the job. From his hospital bed, General Pershing pleaded with FDR to give Marshall a command in the field. Still, everyone presumed that Marshall would command. In November 1943, Roosevelt visited Eisenhower in North Africa and nearly said as much. "You and I know who the chief of staff was during the last years of the Civil War, but practically no one else knows. I hate to think that 50 years from now, practically nobody will know who George Marshall was. That is one of the reasons why I want George to have the big command. He is entitled to establish his place in history as a great general." Still, Roosevelt had doubts. "It is dangerous to monkey with a winning team," he said. He sent Harry Hopkins to gauge Marshall's feelings about the appointment. Marshall would not be drawn in. He told Hopkins that he had served with honor. He would not ask for anything. He would go along good-heartedly with whatever decision the president made. In an interview with Forrest Pogue decades later, Marshall explained his behavior. "I was determined that I should not embarrass the president one way or the other, that he must be able to deal in this matter with a perfectly free hand in whatever he felt was the best interest of the country. I was utterly sincere in the desire to avoid what had happened so much in other wars, the consideration of the feelings of the individual rather than the good of the country." FDR called Marshall into his office on December 6, 1943. Roosevelt beat around the bush for several awkward minutes, raising subjects of minor importance. Then he asked Marshall if he wanted the job. If Marshall had simply uttered the word, "yes," he presumably would have gotten the job. Still, Marshall refused to be drawn in. Marshall told Roosevelt to do what he thought best. Marshall insisted that his own private feelings should have no bearing on the decision. Again and again he refused to express his preference one way or the other. FDR looked at him. "Well, I didn't feel I could sleep at ease if you were out of Washington." There was a long silence. Roosevelt added, "Then it will be Eisenhower." Inwardly, Marshall must have been crushed. Somewhat gracelessly, Roosevelt asked him to transmit the decision to the Allies. As chief of staff, Marshall was compelled to write the order himself. "The immediate appointment of General Eisenhower to command of Overlord Operation has been decided on." He generously saved the slip of paper and sent it to Ike. "Dear Eisenhower, I thought you might like to have this as a memento. It was written very hurriedly by me as the final meeting broke up yesterday, the President signing it immediately. G.C.M." It was the greatest professional disappointment of Marshall's life, and it came about because he refused to express his own desires. But that, of course, was the code he lived by. When the war in Europe was over, it was Eisenhower, not Marshall, who returned to Washington as the triumphant conqueror. Still, Marshall was overcome with pride. John Eisenhower remembered the scene of his father's return to Washington. "It was on that day that I saw General Marshall completely unbend. Standing behind Ike and eschewing the glare of the photographers, he beamed on Ike and Mamie with a kindly, fatherly expression. There was nothing of the normally aloof George Marshall in his demeanor that day. Then he faded into the background and let Ike take the stage for the rest of the day. A motorcade down the streets of Washington, a visit to the Pentagon." In a personal letter, Churchill wrote to Marshall, "It has not fallen to your lot to command the great armies. You have had to create them, organize them, and inspire them." Outshone by the men he had promoted, Marshall had become known simply as the organizer of victory. Final tasks. Marshall spent his post-war life trying to retire. On November 26, 1945, there was a simple ceremony at the Pentagon, and Marshall was released from duty as the Army Chief of Staff. He drove to Dodona Manor, the home he and Catherine had bought in Leesburg, Virginia. They walked through the sunny yard, looking forward to years of leisure and retirement. Catherine went upstairs to rest before dinner and heard the phone ring as she climbed. An hour later, she came downstairs to find Marshall stretched out ashen-faced on a chaise longue, listening to the radio. The news broadcast announced that the U.S. ambassador to China had just resigned, and that George Marshall had accepted the president's request to take his place. The phone call had been President Truman asking Marshall to leave immediately. "Oh, George," she said, "how could you?" The job was thankless, but he and Catherine remained in China for 14 months, trying to negotiate away an inevitable civil war between the Chinese nationalists and communists. On the return flight home from his first major failed mission, Marshall, now 67, was asked again by the president for another favor, to serve as Secretary of State. Marshall accepted and hung up. In his new position, he enacted the Marshall Plan, although he never called it anything but its official name, the European Recovery Plan, and President Roosevelt's wish that Marshall be long remembered by history came true. There were other duties that followed: President of the American Red Cross, Secretary of Defense, Chair of the U.S. Delegation to the Coronation of Elizabeth II. There were highs, winning the Nobel Prize, and lows, becoming the object of a hate campaign by Joe McCarthy and his allies. As each job was offered, Marshall felt the tug of obligation. He made some good decisions and some bad ones. He opposed the formation of the State of Israel. He was continually accepting assignments he did not want. Some people seem to have been born into this world with a sense of indebtedness for the blessing of being alive. They are aware of the transmission of generations, what has been left to them by those who came before, their indebtedness to their ancestors, their obligations to a set of moral responsibilities that stretch across time. One of the purest expressions of this attitude is a letter sent home by a Civil War soldier named Sullivan Ballou to his wife on the eve of the First Battle of Bull Run, early in the war. Ballou, an orphan, knew the pain of growing up without a father. Nonetheless, he wrote to his wife, he was willing to die to pay the debt he owed to his ancestors. "If it is necessary that I should fall on the battlefield for my country, I am ready. I know how strongly American civilization now leans upon the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the Revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life, to help maintain this government, to help pay that debt. But, my dear wife, when I know that with my own joys I lay down nearly all of yours, and replace them in this life with cares and sorrows, when, after having eaten for long years the bitter fruit of the orphanage myself, I must offer it as their only sustenance to my dear little children, is it weak or dishonorable, while the banner of my purpose floats calmly and proudly in the breeze, that my unbounded love for you, my darling wife and children, should struggle in fierce, though useless, contest with my love of country? Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me to you, with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence could break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind, and bears me irresistibly on, with all these chains to the battlefield. I have, I know, but few and small claims upon divine providence, but something whispers to me, perhaps it is the wafted prayer of my little Edgar, that I shall return to my loved ones unharmed. If I do not, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I love you, and when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name." Of course, Ballou did fight the next day at Bull Run, and he did die. Like Marshall, he did have the sense that he couldn't find fulfillment outside of his obligations to community and country. We live in a society that places great emphasis on personal happiness, defined as not being frustrated in the realization of your wants. But old moral traditions do not die. They waft down the centuries and re-inspire new people in new conditions. Marshall lived in the world of airplanes and the nuclear bomb, but in many ways he was formed by the moral traditions of classical Greece and Rome. His moral makeup owed something to Homer, to the classical emphasis on courage and honor. It owed something to the Stoics, with their emphasis on moral discipline. But particularly, later in life, it also owed something to the ancient Athenian Pericles, who embodied the style of leadership that we call magnanimity, or great-souled. The magnanimous leader of Greece's golden age had a high but accurate view of his own virtue. He put himself in a different category from most people around him, understanding that he had been blessed by unusual good fortune. This understanding strained his relations with those around him. He could seem solitary and detached, reserved and dignified, except with a few close friends. He navigated the world with a qualified friendliness, genial to people, but never quite exposing his inner feelings, thoughts, and fears. He hid his vulnerabilities and detested the thought that he might be dependent on others. As Robert Faulkner writes in The Case for Greatness, he is not a joiner, a team player, or a staffer. He does not put his shoulder to any ordinary wheel, especially if he must take a secondary role. Neither is he eager for reciprocity. He is fond of granting favors, but ashamed to receive them. He was, as Aristotle put it, not capable of leading his life to suit anyone else. The magnanimous leader does not have a normal set of social relations. There is a residual sadness to him, as there is in many grandly ambitious people who surrender companionship for the sake of their lofty goals. He can never allow himself to be silly or simply happy and free. He is like marble. The magnanimous leader is called upon by his very nature to perform some great benefit to his people. He holds himself to a higher standard and makes himself into a public institution. Magnanimity can only really be expressed in public or political life. Politics and war are the only theaters big enough, competitive enough, and consequential enough to call forth the highest sacrifices and to elicit the highest talents. The man who shelters himself solely in the realms of commerce and private life is, by this definition, less consequential than one who enters the public arena. By the time of Pericles, the great-souled leader was supposed to carry himself with steadiness and sobriety. He was supposed to be more judicious and self-disciplined than the hot-tempered Homeric heroes. Most of all, he was supposed to provide some public benefit on a grand scale. He was supposed to save his people in a time of peril or transform them to fit the needs of a new age. The great-souled man may not be a good man. He may not always be kind, compassionate, considerate, and pleasant, but he is a great man. He wins great honors because he is worthy of them. He achieves a different style of happiness defined by the popularizer of Greek thought, Edith Hamilton, as the exercise of vital powers along lines of excellence in a life affording them scope. Death. In 1958, Marshall checked into Walter Reed Hospital for the removal of a cyst on his face. His goddaughter Rose Wilson came to visit, stunned at how old he suddenly looked. "I have so much time to remember now," he told her, recalling a time when as a boy he went tobogganing with his father in Uniontown. "Colonel Marshall," she replied, "I'm sorry your father didn't live long enough to know what a great son he had. He would have been very proud of you." "Do you think so?" Marshall answered. "I'd like to believe he would have approved of me." Marshall continued to weaken. Every corner of the earth seemed to respond to the general's illness. Messages arrived from Winston Churchill and General Charles de Gaulle, Mao Tse-tung and Chiang Kai-shek, Joseph Stalin and General Dwight Eisenhower, Marshal Tito and Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery. Thousands of letters from ordinary people poured in. President Eisenhower came to visit three times. Truman visited. Winston Churchill, then 84, also visited. Marshall was in a coma by then, and Churchill could do no more than stand in the doorway weeping as he looked at the small body of the man he had once known. He died on October 16, 1959, just shy of his 80th birthday. General Tom Handy, his old deputy chief of staff, had once asked him about the arrangements for his funeral, but Marshall cut him off. "You don't have to worry about it. I've left all the necessary instructions." These instructions were opened after his death. They were remarkable. "Bury me simply, like any ordinary officer of the U.S. Army who has served his country honorably. No fuss. No elaborate ceremonials. Keep the service short. Confine the guest list to the family. And above everything, do it quietly." At his express order, there was no state funeral. There was no lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda. His body lay in state at the Bethlehem Chapel of the National Cathedral for 24 hours so friends could pay their respects. In attendance at the funeral were family, a few colleagues, and his old wartime barber, Nicholas J. Totalo, who had cut the general's hair in Cairo, Tehran, Potsdam, and later at the Pentagon. Then there was a short plane service at Fort Myer in Arlington, Virginia, using the standard order for the burial of the dead from the Book of Common Prayer, with no eulogy. Chapter 6. Dignity.